discount rate selected, saying if a discount rate was used, it would be expected to. So you're not implying that you are doing it, but just that if you did, then you would get that. And so that's Joe's point, saying you use cost. But if you did a, you know, a check, as I often do, you'd get down there. But you're not saying you have selected, but if you...
I think we're into editorial now, so take this offline. We'll circulate the agenda decision for your final review and editing comments. Thank you, Fabienne. Now, the moment we've all been waiting for. Take a 5G. Historic occasion that we didn't receive any comment letters, including from Deloitte, with or without its period.
I'm glad to see it.
No comment letters, no change to wording, no change to decision.
Unless you guys want to change.
No. Thank you, team. If we can invite some fresh blood to the table for the vampire sister version. And it would be politically incorrect of me, of course, to point out that Shelley is here only for a short duration. So we can't have any prolonged discussions this afternoon. Shelley's first time in front of the IFRIC, and so the normal rules apply that you mustn't upset her or be rude to her. Because of her current condition, I would advise against that anyway. Michael Buschhuter pretends that he's never been in front of us before, but I don't believe him. And Barbara will be joining us later. It is Barbara's first time in front of me. This is a dry run, she tells me, for the presentation she's going to be doing in front of the board later. Topics we're looking at are the things that Alan mentioned to us at the previous meeting. These are some changes that we're contemplating, or some issues that have been raised in the light of implementation experience on IFRS 3 and IS 27, the revised standards which are now in effect and in force. The cover paper describes to you, I think, the different courses of action that the staff is following. Some of them are coming to us here, some of them are coming to the board for annual improvements, and some of them are perhaps going to result in more significant consideration at another time. So we're only focused on the IFRIC things today. Shelley, welcome to this group. You'll find it's very hospitable and warm. You're welcome to give us an introduction as long or as short as you would like.
Thank you, Bob. Yes. Today we're going to discuss several issues. After the board issued the revised IFRS 3, this is combination and IS 27 consolidated and separate financial statements, we have received requests to clarify some of the revised requirements. Although the board has committed itself to perform a post-implementation review 2 years after the effective date of the standards, we believe some of the issues should not be postponed until then because they related to the transition guidance or the effective date of the revised standards. So we also recommend the board and the IFRIC to address a limited number of practice issues that we believe that can be addressed without having a separate project on it, and they are pervasive in nature. So in this meeting, we are presenting 3 issues to the IFRIC, including the transition guidance for acquisition-related costs, the effective date of IFRS 3, and transition costs for transaction with non-controlling interest. We will also present several issues as included in the appendix to the board in its May meeting later, but we do not plan to go over the detail of this. Now let's go on with the first issue, which is in the agenda paper 6A, the acquisition-related costs. So acquisition-related costs are incurred to effect a business combination, and generally we include the advisory, legal, and other professional fees. The issue is that relating to the treatment of these acquisition-related costs that incurred before the adoption of the IFRS 3R but their corresponding business combination will be accounted for under the new revised standard. The question is whether, before the adoption of the revised standard, this corp can still be capitalized or whether they should be expensed off. Because under the old IFRS 3, acquisition-related costs are being included as part of the cost of business combination, which eventually goes to the goodwill, but the new standard requires such costs to be expensed off. We understand there are several views being developed, and the key question underlying all this is that whether the accounting of these acquisition-related costs should be governed by the standard effective when they are incurred, or whether they should be accounted for based on the business combination that they're being accounted for. And the start point is that we believe it should be accounted by the standard that accounted for the business combination. We consider that the acquisition-related cost itself cannot meet the definition of asset on its own, and therefore they can only be capitalized if they are part of the other assets. And because of that reason, they should be accounted for in accordance with the standard which used to account for the business combination that they belong to. And we believe that the capitalization requirement of IFRS 3 should only be applied to the business combination accounted for under that standard and should not be accounted for the other business combination. So our conclusion is that such a capitalization, such a acquisition-related cost should be expensed unless they accounted for under the IAS 32 or 39. We also believe that this conclusion can be determined from the withdrawal of the old IFRS 3 and explanation in IFRS 3R. So we recommend that the effect not to add this issue to its agenda. So we have two questions to the board. Whether the board agree, whether the IFRIC agree with the staff proposal?
If anybody has any comments for clarification of the staff analysis before you answer that question, I'm sure Shelley would be happy to debate those with you. Andrew?
Oh, sorry, it's not really a question for clarification, it's a comment on the issue, really. I understand that the staff recommendation and wouldn't want to take it on the agenda, but you know, if you're preparing a set of accounts under the old standard before a new standard is effective, I kind of find it difficult to rule out that you can't comply with the existing standard, which I assume would allow you to carry forward those costs as some form of prepayment on account of a business combination. I can't see why you could force somebody to look forward to the new standard. So I struggled to rule out, I think it was due B1 in the paper.
So for clarity's sake, Andrew, you would use some other determination to determine whether or not these costs constitute an asset at the reporting date.
Well, what would we do if there was no new business combination standard and we'd incurred these costs at a balance sheet date before we'd actually done the business combination?
Presumably you would make a judgment about whether you thought the business combination was going to be included.
In which case you might well carry them forward. So we are under the old standard at the moment, and I just found it difficult to say you have to look forward to the new one.
But we also have a requirement in IAS 1, IAS 8, that where there's a new standard that's issued, that you have to quantify the effect. So you presumably say that the way you've accounted for the acquisition cost is that you capitalized them, carried them forward as a prepayment, but the effect of adopting the new standard next year when it becomes effective is that you will then write off these costs together with the other acquisition costs.
Yeah, I assume that's right, but I still don't see how you can mandate writing them off in the current period.
In fact,
I have the same comments. I don't see how, when preparing financial statement with the current accounting policy, which allow capitalization of those costs, you would anticipate an accounting change and say, now because of an expected accounting change, I cannot capitalize those costs. I don't think it's the right approach. I think the right approach is to follow whatever the current accounting principle is, and and whether you meet the criteria for capitalization or not. And then when you change the accounting principle, do a change of accounting principle with the write-off of the cost.
I happen to think that the staff has the right answer here, but this issue was kicked around in the U.S. by a group of people, including folks from each of the large firms' national offices, and there were different views around the table. Ultimately, the conclusion was that view A is acceptable, view B2 is acceptable, and view B4, which is not in this paper, is acceptable, which would be capitalize the costs when they are incurred under FAS 141 or IFRS 3, and then expense them in the first period after adoption, not through retained earnings, but through the income statement. The conclusion in the U.S., and as I understand it, this is what has been applied, is either A, B2, or B4. It's a policy choice, and move along. I don't think that was the preferable answer. I think VA is the right answer, but the fact is the question has been addressed using the same words that are in 3R and a different conclusion than that was reached.
While I accept, I can see how you might come to VA, I have difficulty with what thing we would mean by prospective application of any standard, because it seems to me that on the one hand we're saying you apply this new standard prospectively to business combinations that occur in the first annual reporting period beginning on or after this date. Yet just for this little thing, go back and do what the new standard says. So to me the consequences of VA in any standard that has prospective application, it worries me. And I actually query whether view A is in fact in accordance with the standard, because I think you could argue to say if you expense the cost, you would not be in accordance with the provisions of IFRS 3A, which says you must apply it prospectively. So I can see arguments for A. I can see how you got there, but I don't think we can be definitive on it. And I could accept view B2. I think probably view B2 probably I would be comfortable with that one, but I don't think we can be definitive on it, and I'm interested to hear that the US couldn't be definitive on it. I would be very unhappy with us saying VA is the only way. I don't think we can say that.
Just again to clarify that if, as in the circumstances Andrew described, that you've got the acquisition costs that you've been incurring, that you capitalise them because you expect that the business combination is going to take place under the existing IFRS 3. But then the revised version comes out, it's effective, and you follow the accounting for that. So you would expense the acquisition costs that you've incurred. Now, it doesn't say anything on your argument about what happens to what you capitalized before. So my question would be, what do you do with those? You have an asset in the balance sheet. It's not part of the acquisition equation. It's not going to be reflected in goodwill as you would have done before. So where do you put that debit? Do you leave it in assets?
In the next year, yes, you would. And then in the next year when you apply the new standard, you go back and adjust. In any of these myriad of ways.
Oh, okay, sorry. Yeah, so you would write them off?
Yes, afterwards. In the new year, you
right.
apply
okay.
the new standard.
Right.
Yes.
Thank you.
Yes,
but they never actually do. I totally agree with Andrew in Ruth's comments. In fact, I would actually go further and to say that, and I'm very interested in the US views on this, because I would actually argue that view A would not be in accordance with the standards, plural, because IFRS 3 is the standard that applies at the point in time that you are preparing those financial statements, and therefore you must comply with IFRS 3, i.e. if you meet the criteria for capitalising, then you must capitalise them. And therefore I would say that B2 is the only solution. And certainly would then say, yes, you capitalise at that balance date, but it would be expensed immediately afterwards.
Just speaking from a U.S. perspective, working for a company that's had to implement this new standard as well, and talking to many of my peers at other companies, what the thinking was is, what will be the standard in place when the combination is actually effective? Will it be, if you thought that the acquisition wasn't going to happen until after the new year, you're under the new rules, and... And so most companies most U.S. companies just expense them. Once it got to the point that 6 months before the new standard was going to come into effect, they started thinking, when is this deal going to close? And made an assessment, will the new rule apply or the old rule apply?
My head hurts because I've heard this conversation before, been in this conversation before several times. Most companies did exactly as Peggy thought. They said the scope of 141R is business combinations that close after X date. And that is the standard that tells me how to account for costs. And so it is based on the date the combination closed. That's what most companies did. The folks from the firms were absolutely less clear on initial read as to what to do. And I will tell you, we had on the calls that I had, that I was on, somebody who was a member of the FASB project team when they were working on the standard. That person thought the answer was B2. However, others around the table, including people at the firm that person is now at, thought absolutely the answer is A. Others thought absolutely the answer is B4. So the conclusion was, ask the SEC staff if they would object to any of those views. The SEC staff said, make a policy choice, disclose, we don't care. And that's what's written in the firm's guidance now. I mean, you don't have to take my word for these discussions. If you look in the large firms' 141R books, which are also 3R books, they all have this in there.
Not wanting to distrust you at all, but perhaps Janet could like to comment on this.
What I've been told is that the SEC would not object to any of the alternatives as long as there was appropriate disclosure of the accounting policy.
So, the purpose of asking you to raise these questions to clarify the issue is to help you to hear in your minds whether this is an issue that you want to take onto the agenda, to give definitive interpretation requirements as to how these costs should be accounted for, or if, as I hope and trust and pray that you will decide not to take it onto the agenda, and that we'll make that clear through our agenda decision, that we're not going to provide a single definitive answer.
By the time we finish an interpretation, does this issue be around at all? Because by then, the new standard would apply, and they would have to expense it anyway.
Well, you're quite right, actually. That's a very persuasive point. So by the time we concluded on this, that all the expenses would have been written off one way or another, and it would no longer be of continuing interest. So I gather you're in favor of not taking it on. Fortunately, Ken was on the mic, so I'm not going to repeat that. Ask the question again. Does anybody feel that we should take this onto the agenda?
No, I would not say... No, I have a question which is more general, because I believe that there are other aspects of transition with IFRS 3 revised, including, for example, the acquisition of minority interests. And in taking every subject individually, you might come to the conclusion that there is nothing to say. But in my view, we might have something to say more generally on transition on IFRS 3. So that's my point.
Of course, these are the issues that have been raised with the staff involved in the project. That's all we're asked to deal with at the moment.
Yeah.
So I wouldn't encourage you to go any further, but the same points that Bernd raised on the previous issue will apply to the two-year post-implementation review, that if people are still having trouble with transition after 2 years, is it something we can fix? I think the answer is probably going to be no.
Yeah, but we also try to address some of the transition issues in our board meeting as well, which is actually in the appendix.
All right. Shirley has given you some proposed wording for the tentative agenda decision. Are there any changes that you would like to make to this? Editorials, of course, we'll take offline, but any changes in substance, or do you think this reflects now the decision? No? Ruth?
No, I think the agenda decision is too definitive. It reflects the UA only. I think it needs to say that there are different ways and that we won't give a definitive answer, and that as long as the company discloses what it's done,
I think we do have to change the agenda decision based on this discussion. The only question is whether we want to say that some views are unacceptable. View B1, perhaps, which implies that once you capitalize the costs under IFRS 3, you just leave them capitalized, even though the business combination closes under 3R. I suspect we all believe that B1 is inappropriate. I don't know about B3. That was a new one on me. Opening balance of retained earnings without restatement of the comparative period. That was confusing to me. Like I said, in the U.S., people made up of B4, which expensed them in the first period after adoption, not ran them through opening retained earnings. But I think we do have to change the kind of agenda decision because it doesn't reflect what we discussed.
Well, we must be careful that in our agenda decision we don't give definitive interpretive guidance, and that applies both ways.
This is the issue. Yeah. If you deleted the word in the period in which the costs are incurred, because I think the issue is that everybody agrees they need to be expensed. The question we've got is whether they should be expensed in the first period or the second period. So you simply say that they acquired an energy sound acquisition related costs as expenses.
I actually think the issue is the last sentence of that second paragraph. I mean, I think the middle bits are factual. That is what the standard requires. And whereas the last sentence is, to me, that is what is saying, giving you saying it's got to be view A, which I think is the wrong interpretation. So I think it's the last sentence that needs changing. I think the bits before that are purely factual. That is what the standard says. The question is how you then get it to deal with that in the, which period do you deal with it in?
Can I just disagree? Because I don't think the last, the ultimate thing is that the, I think the last sentence tells you you need to expense it. I don't think it tells you which period to expense it in, but you do need to expense it. And I think that the message is, and Andrew said, you would anticipate which one you think you're going to be accounting for within in essence, and that's why you probably capitalise it. But, not necessarily. You might, the thing I'm still struggling to work out what this asset is. Normally it's just part of goodwill, and you haven't got a business combination under the old IFRS 3 yet. Nothing's happened.
Also, just for the avoidance of doubt, my interpretation of what view B1 is not to carry forward the asset indefinitely, but to write them off in the next year, i.e. expense them in the new year. And I just to come to Scott's point about can we rule any out? It might be difficult based on this conversation because I kind of struggle with view B2 that we're now in the next year implementing a standard which is prospective only, yet we seem to have view B2 start talking about prior adjustments. So that seems counterintuitive. I just wanted to make clear that my view of B1 is you write it off in the next year, not you carry it forward forever. So
that's actually your B4.
That was my B4. I read it differently. So.
But to Scott's point, and apparently the way the SEC is looked at this, if this is an accounting policy choice on what you do with acquisition expenses for business combinations that don't close before the reporting date, then by definition, your accounting policy changes as a result of the new standard. That's, I think, how you get to retrospective assessment.
Okay, well, I think the current agenda decision clearly is view A, and based on this discussion, I think, I'm not sure we should draft it around the table, but needs a fairly significant rewrite to reflect the variety of views around the table.
The comment I was going to make earlier, in reading the agenda decision, it looked to me like we had written an interpretation there. And we had gone through the staff analysis, we had written the interpretation, and the interpretation was view A. And our discussion didn't seem to lead to that. So I would agree with Andrew that last sentence leads you to only one possible accounting policy choice, and we've all said, gee, there are other choices you could make.
There are, I think, to Alan's point, though, is the timing question, because eventually it will be accounted for under the new standard. And I would add that word, that eventually the accounting for acquisition-related costs is dependent on the standard applicable to the business combination. His point was maybe we should change the middle thing that says that IFRS, the revised IFRS 3, requires you to do to account for them as expenses in the period in which the costs are incurred, but the old IFRS 3 wouldn't have required you to expense them in the period in which they were incurred if you anticipated. So it's really that eventually, if that business combination doesn't close before the effective date, the new IFRS 3 is going to make them be written off. So it's really, it's a timing question. So we'll just have to figure out how we deal with the words in the middle to make that clear. Want us to say it's an accounting policy choice?
I think we really should include that. But then that's the hook for people to say, well, if it's material, it's an accounting policy choice, and if it's material, I'll disclose the amount and where it's located, which I think is what the regulators will be looking for. Janet had an opportunity to speak. Patrick, I don't know if you have any other comments or if you agree with your sisters across the Atlantic.
I think
give you all the detailed words in here. What we're proposing is that first paragraph describes that it's expenses incurred under the old IFRS 3 for a business combination that is only going to be concluded and when the new IFRS 3 is applied, that the second paragraph should note in some way, perhaps with a little bit more explanation, that under IFRS 3 revised, acquisition expenses are expensed, or the acquisition costs are expensed, and therefore they will be expensed. It's an accounting policy choice that is made to determine how to account for the acquisition costs before then.
I think your proposal to underline that it's an accounting policy choice is fine.
All right, well, a little bit of a rewrite, but I think we've got it clear what we would like you to do, Shelley. Thank you for that. Are you going to stay at the table and keep an eye on your colleague, or are you going to introduce the next point? Or are you going to take your leave of us now?
Okay, we're moving then to Agenda Paper 6B, which deals with early application of IFRS 3. IFRS 3 permits early application of the standard, but limits that early application to the beginning of the reporting period. And the IFRIC has received a couple of requests to clarify that statement in the standard, and Firstly, we have some constituents who question whether the wording in the standard truly reflects the board's intention at the time when it decided about that requirement, and then that some constituents believe that the true intention of the board was to allow early application from any given point of in time during a reporting period. Other constituents asked for clarification with respect to when we require early application for a full annual reporting period, on whether at any given point in time during that reporting period that policy choice could be made, and if so, earlier transactions and business combinations would have to be restated. The staff recommends not to add this issue to the agenda. For once, we believe that the wording in the standard is clear that we require early application for a full reporting period. And we have also gone back to the documentation of the board deliberations, and then we think that truly reflects the board's intention at that time. Secondly, we think that the question on whether at any given point during the reporting period you could make a policy choice over the early application of the full report for the full reporting period, that's not a question that's special to the application of IFRS 3, but that's a question that generally arises for all standards where we allow earlier application. And we believe that question can be answered in accordance with IFRS 8. I would therefore like to ask the IFRIC on whether the IFRIC agrees that it should not add a project to its agenda to clarify the requirements for earlier application of the revised IFRS 3. If you disagree with that staff recommendation, then I would like to ask you why you disagree.
Well, Michael's given us a new slant on the first time in front of the IFRIC, that you've got to be nice to him, but he can be aggressive to us. Keeping us in our place very well there, Michael. Anybody disagree? Nope. Good. And the wording of the agenda? Oh, sorry, Ruth. Oh, by the way, I just meant to point out that the clock isn't working behind you.
I know. When I sat down, I felt this was a really bad seat. Not good having that thing behind me there.
Perhaps we can put some geomancy artifacts in it.
I'm comfortable with the agenda decision. I just wondered whether we could include a bit more guidance that you already have in the staff analysis. Because I think the question is, if I have two transactions in that same reporting period, do I have to apply it early to both, or can I only do it for one or the other? And I think you've concluded that you should apply it to all of them, but we haven't actually said that in the agenda decision. So, I think that was the question they were asking. So I think we should be specific on that.
I guess my comment is very similar, which is I thought it was all fine, but it actually doesn't address what the actual question asked was. Like, you know, and we know that's the answer, but it doesn't actually say, well, what is the issue we're addressing, which I think is the same thing that Ruth is saying. So it just needs that in there.
I'm confused. I don't understand. If two transactions are within one period and I can apply it only at the beginning of this period, then how can I possibly apply it differently to one or the other?
We would expect that sort of response from an academic. It is, of course, absolutely correct. All right. Michael, if you can just clarify the language then in the agenda decision, circulate that, I think that's fine. And Barbara has now joined us at the table, so we welcome you here. We will try not to interrupt. Please don't be too cruel to the IFRIC members. This is your first time.
Thank you. If we can turn to agenda paper 60. To address transaction costs for NCI. The IFRIC has received requests to clarify the treatment of transaction costs relating to acquisition and disposal of non-controlling interests that do not result in a loss of control. IAS 27 specifically addresses these transactions as equity transactions, but is silent to the treatment of the costs associated with them. The revised IFRS 3 specifically addresses transaction costs for business acquisitions, stating that they are separate from the actual exchange and should be expensed as incurred. Some constituents have made the argument that the transaction costs for acquisition and disposal of NCI are also separate from the related transaction and are reflective of the fair value of services provided and should be expensed as well. The staff feels that it is not appropriate to analogize these costs to IFRS 3 because the transactions in question are economically different from a business combination. IAS 27 applies to changes in ownership of a subsidiary and classifies these as equity transactions, and we believe the related costs should be treated in the same manner. IAS 32 would then apply and the cost should be deducted from equity. Therefore, the staff recommends that the IFRS does not add this issue to the agenda because the relevant guidance already exists in IFRSs. Does the IFRS agree with the staff's recommendation?
Agree with the conclusion, but I think the rationale is supported in IAS 1, not in IAS 32. I had difficulty with describing the OCI as a financial instrument, which is what came through in the staff paper. I think the guidance, and I've just got the reference here, IAS 1, para 106B, little 3, and IAS 1, para 109, actually give the answer in respect of OCI, and I can quite clearly say you deduct the costs from the OCI.
So,
because I had difficulty with...
Sorry, OCI or NCI?
NCI, sorry. What did I call it? Sorry. NCI. I think the guidance is given there, and I don't disagree with the answer, but I was a bit troubled by reference to the non-controlling interest as a financial instrument, because it isn't. It's equity. And that's why the answer that it's equity is already there in IS1. And 109. Obviously,
you've managed to pick on a very interesting paragraph that would seem to describe what it is we're trying to say, but would be more specific, more explicit. So would members think we should amend the agenda decision to incorporate the reference to that paragraph? Yeah. Okay. Any other comments on that? All right, then subject to just reviewing the final wording then, that's something that we have also determined we'll not add to our agenda. Barbara, thank you very much. I hope that wasn't too rough on you either.
Yeah.
And I shall look forward to your first presentation to the board. Now have a look at one of the new items that's come into us.
Brand new.
So Michael, you gave us a lot of entertainment this morning. I hope you'll continue to set.
Sure.
Gender item 7.
A brand new issue from both November and March. The two remaining issues
that came up initially as a result of the staff's review of the EITFO 86 that came up. The two issues that are still remaining, issue one, how the initial carrying value of an equity method investment should be determined, and issue three, how an equity method investee's issue of shares should be accounted for. It should be noted in paragraph six that the board is already considering and reviewing in their disclosure draft on ED10 whether or not a project should be opened up. That was already referenced by Alan earlier today. So these two issues are already being included in that analysis and consideration, which will be presented to the board at a future date. So that's just kind of for your FYI. But in regards to issue one, how the initial carrying value of an equity method investment should be determined, the staff did research, looked through various IFRSs, and found there to be two common principles. If there is a fair value through profit or loss notion, transaction costs and other costs that are going to be incremental to the acquisition would not be included in the value that's recorded as an asset, and that it would be expensed. All other measurement models or methods, cost, amortized cost, available for sale, things like that, would allow these transaction costs or require these transaction costs to be included in the cost basis. With that said, the staff believes that there are principles that are consistent throughout IFRS that should allow users to figure this out. As equity method is not a fair value through profit or loss notion, these transaction costs should be included in the cost basis. Does anyone have any comments on issue one?
We've been discussing this for a couple of meetings now. When we looked at cost in this context, did we encompass contingent consideration and how that would be dealt with under associates?
Contingent consideration wasn't expressly thought about in this context, but it is being included in the board's overall ED10 IS-28 consideration.
And the contingent consideration issue in IFRS 3 is one of those things that's going to the board later this month.
I have a question regarding paragraph 10 in the paper, because it says that in the staff's opinion, costs according to IS-28 means all amounts paid at the inception of ownership of the investment in the associate. And I was thinking of situations where purchases are made at separate times, and initially the investment is accounted for according to IS-39, available for sale, for instance. Therefore, at some time when the buyer gets the significant influence and therefore recognizes an associate in its account, the question is it really the initial price paid that is representing the cost to the issuer, or is it the value of the available for sale instruments according to IS-39 at the time the investment becomes an associate?
I believe when you trip from you have a significant event going from a non-associate to an associate level, that is going to be an event where you would kind of have a deemed sell-off of all your prior holdings, and the fair value on that date is the implicit cost of what you're getting.
The case is
very typical of a company that is acquired share, having had to have a big loss on them, and now gaining significant influence. What would be the initial cost? Would it be the original cost, or would it be the impaired cost, the impaired value?
That's a good question, Gilbert. What's the answer?
I don't know. That's
always the equity value.
You've got wise people here around. So
just to link, it's not written, which is the accounting treatment that you have to apply in this situation. In my opinion, looking at the old IFRS 3, you can choose to go to an approach in which you look at the value of the equity method when you acquired the association, and therefore you come back as the equity method that has always been applied starting from the beginning, and the revaluation is put in the equity account. With the new IFRS, it's not written, and this was also one thing that I have said a couple of meetings ago. I think that we should think about this, because it seems that it's an economic relevant event, and therefore that a fair value has to be applied, but it's not clear.
Got to be careful we don't go too far, Patrick. I wish you hadn't raised this issue.
I'm sorry,
about significant events. The remeasurement trigger that's in IFRS 3 is for a significant event from moving from not having control to control, or moving from control to losing control. And those are the significant events.
Yes.
Significant influence, on the other hand, is something that I think you said this morning you would like to get rid of. And so significant influence may actually not be a significant economic event, that is gaining significant influence in equity accounting. The transition, I think, from having something that's available for sale with the appreciation between original cost and current fair value being kept in OCI, I'm not sure that the literature in 39 can be read in such a way as to say that because you've changed the way in which you present available for sale, that something that was available for sale is now equity accounted, that you can release to profit and loss all of that accumulated amount. So this may be another thing that you want Alan and his team to look at for you.
Well, the thing is, it's a problem I am currently facing. And my understanding was that cost meant the value on the balance sheet on the day before you obtain significant influence. And if this decision of IFRIC for the agenda says, no, it's the cost initially, I'm not very comfortable with this.
Some of your colleagues and countrymen who are not comfortable with other things that we do, but the purpose of having the standards is for people to follow them so that there is comparability. And we didn't change IAS 28, changing cost. So where there is a triggering event that requires remeasurement, restatement, and remeasurement typically stepping down from a controlled subsidiary to an investment in an associate, where there isn't an attributable amount in the previous financial statements to allocate, that causes a measurement at that date. Then going the other way, you may be uncomfortable with the result, but I don't think that's up for discussion this afternoon. Andrew?
Sorry, just one other point I meant to mention. I think what we're trying to do here is give guidance on what cost means at initial recognition, which is paragraph 11 of IAS 28. We should probably mention that in the agenda decision. We don't mention that paragraph anywhere in the agenda.
Just in terms of this as a whole, if Michael said this is being dealt with by the board, because they were both issue 1 and issue 3. There were two questions that were asked in ED 10. And secondly, this actually wasn't an approach to IFRIC on this is a problem or this is diversity, please deal with it. These came from the EITF considerations. Given those two facts, do we actually need to put out a tentative agenda decision? I.e., do we need to actually do anything on the basis that
my recollections are that the IFRIC has the staff to look at these items. So having had it in front of us, the disposition of it is that we make a decision.
Well, taking that further then, just looking at Appendix A, if we do intend to do this, A, can we do some form of link from the EITF to actually what we're addressing? I.e., the first paragraph doesn't link to anything else. And given that this is so simple and it's being taken on, do we really need 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 paragraphs?
So paragraph 3 doesn't link.
Sorry, paragraph 1 states some facts, and then, but it doesn't, there are no, it just doesn't link to the following comments. Well, I couldn't find any link.
Turn it around another way then and have an introductory paragraph which describes the two questions that we're addressing. Yeah, okay. Well, we replace the existing paragraph 1. With a description of the questions that we're going to be addressing. And again, for clarity, and Scott, you raised the point this morning that we seem to do our best not to take on interpretive projects. It isn't our policy to track every EITF or every issue that the EITF looks at in order to determine what its impact might be in the IFRS world. So it's perhaps not necessary to give that direct reference to EITF's activities. Describe what the questions are, because there are two questions. I think we do have more than the usual three paragraphs. So second paragraph addresses question 1, third paragraph addresses question 2, and then we conclude why we've not taken it onto the agenda. So it's pretty much as we've got in here. Would people be happy with that approach? You'd be happy with that approach? Okay.
Does everyone agree with the staff's thought process and conclusion on issue 1? And I guess moving on to issue 3, how an equity method investee's issue of shares should be accounted for. The staff points to paragraph 19A of IS 28 with a specific reference to the treatment of the OCI component and provides the additional analysis that, you know, we believe the total treatment of profit or loss would and should be treated in the same way. Does the IFRIC agree with the staff's conclusions?
I'm in disagreement, but I think that we are making an argument from one part of the problem and on the whole problem, because the part which is an OCI, that could be a profit outside the OCI, and I mean, I think that we are not necessarily in a position to make a conclusion only from the treatment of the part which is in OCI. It is only one part of the problem.
But how could you possibly be recycling something out of OCI if you didn't have something to report in?
No, I don't disagree, but I don't disagree on the conclusion, but I think the argument is maybe not sufficient. That's my point. I guess you don't so much. I don't expect myself to work correctly. I try to find another argument. Okay.
I guess what I'm trying to figure out is, if the conclusion is the right conclusion, what other support do we need for the conclusion, other than
I know that there was different practice on that. Even if I have not the argument to do it in a different manner, but I know that there's different in practice.
Okay, I think I'll accept that.
To add on, I happen to think that this is the best accounting, what the staff proposes. I didn't necessarily conclude that the cited paragraph 19A proscribed that accounting. What is described in paragraph 19A is an item that has already been remeasured by the associate, and we are merely reclassifying the remeasurement. We are, I think, making somewhat of a leap to say in the agenda decision that same result in profit and loss applies to things that the associate has not yet remeasured, but we will remeasure them implicitly as part of our accounting for the fact that the associate has issued additional shares. I happen to think it provides the best accounting. I am not sure that the cited paragraph provides the support that's the only answer.
Are you suggesting the final sentence is deleted?
No, I think it's clear that paragraph 19A applies to all reductions. That is to say, it's clear that any amount in OCI needs to be recycled to P&L. It's not clear that we then recognize a gain or loss to the extent that our implicit interest changes.
I think Scott is expressing about the same idea. I could not express that I have the same feeling.
I think paragraph 19A is absolutely clear with respect to an amount that's in OCI because the investee has already done the remeasurement. But we're implying that paragraph 19A also says we must do a further remeasurement when our ownership interest changes because the investee issues additional shares. As I said, I like that accounting. I think it makes sense. But I don't know that paragraph 19A absolutely gets me there.
I'm really struggling with how you account for a reduction in the investor's proportionate interest without and take, as a result of that, take a proportionate piece of the pieces that are of that interest that are sitting in OCI through income without taking the main of the proportionate interest of the main investment through income.
Well, I've already affected my carrying balance of the investment for the changes that are sitting in OCI. That's already been done through my equity accounting. So
you've already affected your equity accounting with the regular income pickup too.
Well, hang on. I've already affected what's sitting on my balance sheet as investments in associates. The question we are asking, the question that is posed is, when the investee sells additional shares, do I, as the investor, make an adjustment to my reported investment in associate? Okay, there are two possibilities. One is I do make an adjustment, the other is I do not. Neither of them is dependent upon what I do with the amount sitting in OCI. The amount sitting in OCI can be reclassified to P&L and is required to be according to paragraph 19A. And that can be done without affecting my reported asset investment in associate. And we've just gone through a fairly long discussion about how the investment in associate is a cost-based measure. Well, my cost didn't change. My equity pickup was done according to the guidance, and I didn't sell anything. I didn't get cash. I didn't reduce the number of shares. I think one could make that argument and say, therefore, my reported investment in associate balance ought not change. As I said, that's not the analysis I prefer. I prefer the analysis that's in this paper. But I don't know the paragraph 19A gets me.
Maybe we've got the wrong paragraph number. But it seems to me that one of the things that the application of the equity method does is it says you're supposed to pick up your proportionate interest in changes in the equity accounts of the investee. And I don't know how you do that by ignoring the fact that your proportionate interest has changed. I mean, because basically, if whatever they issued the shares for, presumably they got something in return. So you've got some shift about. So I guess what one of the things that we were struggling with was how you get, and this is, I guess, the logic path that we were following, is the board dealt with losing significant influence and talks about, and it doesn't particularly talk about how you do that. So if we follow the line of logic that is implied by what you and Jean-Louis have been saying, we would clearly get different answers depending on how that proportionate interest changed. If I actually sell shares, I get one answer. I recycle my OCI amount. And in the other situation where my proportionate interest changed because the investee sells shares, I recycle only the OCI amounts and I get a different answer from what I would have.
Which is why I prefer the analysis in the paper. I just, again, I didn't see that the language cited necessarily required that answer. I've heard others argue in the other direction, even knowing about the existence of these words.
I must admit I'm getting confused. Paragraph 18 and 19 of IAS 28 make it very clear when an entity discontinues the use of the equity method, when it ceases to have significant influence, and what it should do, that it should effectively measure the remaining bit it's got at fair value and take the difference to P&L, and that the IAS 39 bit is now at fair value. So that is what you do about your proportionate interest in the equity investment itself. 18 and 19 makes it very clear. 19A, I thought, was simply saying, oh dear, I've got all this stuff sitting in OCI relating to revaluation and all the things that go to OCI that you normally do on consolidation and equity accounting, and I ain't got that anymore because I'm now just holding an investment. So what do I do with those bits? That's what 19A is talking about to me, and it's just saying how you get rid of those bits out of 19A, out of OCI. Either you recycle them or you just transfer them to your other assets, whereas 18 and 19 are dealing with your actual investment itself.
Right, 18 and 19 do not apply.
Why?
Because you retain significant influence. 18 and 19 are about losing significant influence. So the situation we're dealing with is that you held 30% and had significant influence. The investee issues more shares. Now you're down to 25%. But you still have significant influence.
All right. We're lapsing now into an educational session. What I suggest is we allow staff to reflect on these comments to see if they want to make a reference to any other paragraph. I sense that we had agreement with a conclusion, and it's a tentative conclusion, so we'll put it out for comment from our constituents. If they don't see the same leap of faith that some of you think we've had to take in here, then I'm sure they'll write back and tell us. Andrew?
Just one other point on the draft wording. I think we're going to end up saying we didn't expect divergent interpretations in practice. Is fine, but then at the end of the agenda decision, we kind of say, as part of the re-deliberation process, the staff intend to incorporate these two issues into the analysis to be presented to the board. And I wondered whether there's any potential conflict in those two statements, because on the one hand, we say, well, we think we've got the answer, don't expect divergence, and then on the other hand, we say, well, we're going to, that might imply we're pushing to the board and therefore might imply some uncertainty.
Would you be happy if we remove that final paragraph? It's additional information, but we can take that out. Okay. Thank you for that. You're not allowed to go yet. Michael, let's have another bit of fun with associates.
Supporting Joe's original recommendation.
To bring up one more issue on IAS 28, a submission was sent into the IFRIC regarding the impairment of investments in associates and whether or not it is appropriate, whether or not it was purposeful or appropriate to have two different impairment models, one impairment model for the consolidated financial statements and one impairment model in the separate financial statements. Both impairment models would be regarding the investment in the associate. The staff's view is that for consolidated purposes, the consolidated entity should be looking to IAS 28 for how to account for their proportionate ownership in the investee, and that the applicable impairment model is under IAS 36. A narrow portion of this broader question has already been defined and discussed and approved by the board in last year's meeting. That specific question was in regards to specifically the goodwill component that's buried down in there, or implicit goodwill component. This is in regards to the whole thing. For the separate financial statements, the board has already discussed back in the basis of conclusions, they believe that in the separate financial statements, the view of this investment in associate is more as a true investment of a financial asset. And therefore, in the staff's view, the impairment model should follow IAS 39. Does the IFRIC agree with the staff's conclusions?
Personally, I disagree with the conclusion because it seems to me very strange that for the single enterprise financial statement and for the consolidated financial statement has been adopted two so different approach in considering the impairment of the same assets. And in my opinion, it is very strong to indicate that in a separate financial statement, this kind of associates has to be looked like a financial investment activity. I believe that we should maintain some differences among those financial assets that have to be included inside the AS 39 and those other equity financial instruments that are outside the equity, outside the AS 39, and that also have some characteristics that justify, even in the single enterprise or separate financial statements, the application of AS 36. From the perspective of those that prepare financial statements, it's quite clear that if you have 20%, 25% in an entity, in your single enterprise financial statement, you look at these entities considering these investments not in a financial perspective but in an industrial or economic perspective, and you look at what has happened in your consolidated financial statement in order to provide an appropriate level. I will for me, it will be very difficult to explain to the market why you have made an impairment or you have not made an impairment in the single enterprise financial statement, and you have made exactly the opposite situation in the consolidated financial statement. It's something that I cannot understand.
Why would the market see the separate financial statement? Why would the market see the separate financial statement?
For instance, in some jurisdiction like Italy, separate financial statement has absolutely the same relevance as consolidated financial statement. It's absolutely the same thing. The general meeting approved the single enterprise financial statement, and it's low. So.
I don't want to turn this into Europe versus the rest of the world. I mean, there are other jurisdictions around the world that, for stupid reasons of their own, insist on people producing separate financials. consolidated basis give different figures from the separate financial statements of a parent where it accounts for its investments in subsidiaries and in associates on a different basis than it does in consolidated. So wouldn't an investor expect to see different figures? That there may be an impairment that's required at the group level because of the higher carrying amount that are contained in the group figures, as opposed to an impairment in a separate financial statement when, for example, the equity held investment or the significant investment was accounted for as cost.
I agree with you that there is the topic to express two different figures, and is natural in this way because I apply equity method for consolidated financial statement. I apply cost over value for single enterprise financial statement. But when I have to look at the value of those assets, I believe that the approach of looking at the higher amount between fair value and value in use is the best way also for the single enterprise financial statement, because it's the way that better represents the economic value of this element. There are clearly cases, especially in this period, in which the fair value of the market does not absolutely represent the real economic value of the instrument. And if we are speaking about an associate that at least is listed in a market, and in this case the market is very low, but the economic substance can be proved also by an independent valuation, I do not understand why I have to recognize an impairment in a single enterprise financial statement and not to recognize this in a consolidated financial statement only because I'm looking at the IAS 36 in a consolidated and the IAS 39 in a single enterprise financial statement. This is my point.
I'm just trying to check the reference on this as to whether the exemption in IAS 39 and the cost exemption in IAS 36 apply only if the investment is equity accounted or also if it's measured at cost. Because I think the argument in the staff paper is on the assumption that if it's equity accounted, it's excluded from 39. I was just trying to see if it's measured at cost in a separate financial statement, do the cost exemptions between 39 and 36 also apply? Or is it only if it's equity accounted?
It's not clear. When you look at IAS 28, it says, 27, in these separate financial statements, they'll be measured either at cost, not defined, or in accordance with IAS 39. If you go to IAS 39, paragraph 2A says that basically equity method accounting or thereabouts IAS 28, 39, or 31 are going to be excluded from the IAS 39 accounting unless that accounting specifically refers you back into 39. So,
but it doesn't say equity method accounting. It says investments to which IAS 28 apply. It doesn't actually say to investments which we are applying the equity method to. So what I was trying to check, and I haven't found the reference, is
correct.
IAS 28 talks somewhere about using the cost method in a separate financial statement. So therefore, you could, and I can't find the reference.
27.
So you could argue that therefore that the scope exclusion in 39 is for investments in associates, whether they are measured at cost or under the equity method, in which case the 36 cost exemption to 39 would apply to the investments measured at cost in the separate financial statements, in which case you'd get the same outcome that you are doing.
I think the reference is in 27, but as far as the equity method, I think, at least from my own personal view, it's fairly clear that the equity method is excluded from the scope of 39. For the separate financial statements as listed in IAS 27, in accordance with, IAS 39, that very clearly is in IAS 39. I think there may be a question as to the separate financial statements accounted for at cost. Now, the...
Yeah. Not in 28.
because for separate financial statements, the investment is accounted for in the investor or separate financial statements in accordance with the 27.
At least from the staff view, looking at the purpose of the separate financial statements and the board's basis of conclusion as to the purpose, it was much more focused on an investment as opposed to a long-term strategic item for which you have significant influence over. So it's two different viewpoints for which you're trying to pull together the financial statements, the separate financial statements versus consolidated financial statements. So therefore, there are going to be different measurement models. One is going to allow the equity method and one is not. And that's why there are going to be different measurement models, and the staff believes it's appropriate to have, therefore, separate impairment models.
Only to think to add, this is real that the equity method cannot be applied in a separate financial statement, it's clear, and I'm worried about this approach, and I'm still worried about the risk of an analogy approach in a separate financial statement for subsidiaries, because the reference seems quite the same. So there is the risk to extend by analogy this approach, that is to look at the AS 39 for impairment in a separate financial statement, not only to associates but also to subsidiaries. And I do not agree with looking at an associate like a financial office, and strongly if I look at the associates. Think also that there are cases in which you have an individual financial statement, that is a financial statement when you have only an associate, and in this case it's unclear, and they are absolutely different in practice, and we have seen cases in which an individual financial statement equity method has been applied. Therefore, in this case you have one entity, the same entity that is an associate in a separate financial statement that has a EAS 39 reference for the impairment, an individual financial statement with the same entities that has a 36 reference for the impairment. On the consolidated financial statement, in both cases, you look at the EAS 36. I don't believe that is homogeneous. I am strongly worried about this approach.
Your initial question was, do you disagree with the staff view or question? And I do, for similar reasons as Luca, in terms of the analysis, that in relation to saying that the consolidation of subsidiaries is the same as equity accounting and therefore it's justified. That's where I really come to a difference, because to me, IAS 36, when you consolidate subsidiaries, you've got the individual assets and liabilities, and you are applying 36 to those individual assets and liabilities as appropriate, or whatever it is, the financial assets or your fixed assets, whereas what you have in equity accounting is you have one investment. Yes, okay, the standard says apply IAS 36, and I actually think this comes back to our initial comment at the very beginning in terms of should IAS 28 be withdrawn? Because yes. I think it begs the question as to whether, and this is the difficulty that we have every time, is IAS 28 a consolidation standard or is it a valuation standard? If you think it is a measurement of an investment, then I would argue 36 is totally inappropriate and 39 should apply. If it is a consolidation, well, quite frankly, I don't know whoever is in this room that helps write this, and I'm not sure that anybody is, but it is half and half, and I think that is the problem, and that I actually agree that I think it, because I believe it is a valuation and it is not consolidation, that's my personal view, because I don't believe it's a half. I might as well say this, it's a half-ass consolidation. And I don't believe that, therefore it is. Therefore, I don't believe 36 should apply. I think that it is an investment, and I actually think that 39 should apply in terms of the hazard. However, having said all that, I don't actually know what the solution is. I disagree with the analogy to IAS 36 being applied to consolidated financial statements, because I don't think it's the same. However, it would appear that the standard is fairly clear that 36 does have to be applied. Therefore, if you like, from an interpretation perspective, I'm actually not convinced we've got anything to interpret in that it's clear that 36 does apply.
Yes,
I happen to think it's the wrong answer.
But it applies to the associates in the
consolidated.
Yes, yes. And the question was, what applies in the separate?
Well, and to me, that's clear that it's 39. I'm agreeing with your conclusion. I'm disagreeing with some of the analysis in the paper. So yes, I'm agreeing with your conclusion that it's clear. I disagree with the...
You disagree with IS 28.
I disagree with the fact that that is the situation. So I'd refer it to the ISB and say fix it.
I don't get to the same position as a staff, at least not as quickly as they do, because IS 39 clearly takes out of its scope things that are accounted for under IS 28, investment in associates, and IS 28 talks about consolidated and separate financial statements. So on the one hand, that paragraph takes you out of 39, yet we seem to end up back in 39 in this conclusion. So I struggle with that a bit, and I think part of the reason for that is in the paragraph 8 of the staff's paper, where it talks about both the 39, both accommodating the fair value and cost model, I'm not sure I fully agree with that, because in terms of equity instruments, the cost model under 39, I think, is only relevant where you can't get a reliable measurement. And if I read paragraph BC66, which seems to be the basis for the staff paper, I kind of read that in a slightly different way, because it talks about accounting using the fair value method in accordance with IAS 39, and then goes on to a completely different topic about accounting under cost. So I don't read BC6 as saying 39 accommodates both the cost and the fair value model, as paragraph 8 of the staff paper would imply. So I think basically, you end up in 36.
And I guess if I can clarify the BC 66 paragraph of IS 27, the reference to in accordance with 39 at first kind of confused me a little, like what part of 39, because there is cost in there, there is available for sale, there is otherwise. If you read the paragraph before it, BC 65, it clarifies that originally the board had allowed three different models, one of them being, cost, equity method, and available for sale in accordance with 39. As a part of the amendments that occurred in 2003, they switched over and said, okay, we're only going to allow two, the two being cost and fair value to profit and loss. So the words in paragraph BC66 in accordance with IAS 39, I personally read to say fair value to profit or loss. That's my own personal reading for what it means. But
I'll just come back. Well, I'm not sure I read it the same way, and it just seems odd that we're scoped out of 39 and we end up back in there.
With regards to the prior comment of IS 39 paragraph 2A scopes out investments accounted for in accordance with 28. Yes, paragraph 35 of IS 28 does basically, I guess, two very, very short paragraphs of one sentence each on separate financial statements. But the only thing that it says is separate financial statements aren't here. Go look at IS 27. So I guess I would say they're not actually included in IS 28 anywhere other than the fact that we're telling you to go look somewhere else. I would say separate financial statements are accounted for in accordance with paragraphs 38 to 43 of IS 27.
But that, I think that's debatable. So I'm not sure we can be definitive with the answer. Because para 35 is part of IS 28. And it says in the separate financial statements you account for the investment at cost in accordance with IS 27. So I think you could argue that the reference the scoping out in IAS 39, para 2, scopes out accounting for investments under IAS 28, whether by the equity method or cost. You could read it that way. You could read it your way, but you could read it the other way as well.
From the comments, sounds that you don't think that IAS 28 and 39 are clear to how we apply impairment to investments in associates in a separate financial statement. Would you prefer to change your conclusion to say that we're not clear? Or to put it another way to help you make up your mind, do you think that this is an issue that is of sufficient importance that we should take it onto the agenda as an interpretive project?
I would refer it to the board because, you know, I think it's an issue in practice. It's a current issue in practice. All of these impairment issues are very, we need to help people resolve these issues quickly. We're coming up to another one.
Well, if you refer it to the board, it's not something that is going to be addressed quickly.
I don't think we can reach a conclusion ourselves. I don't think we can interpret it.
I don't answer a lot of questions dealing with separate financial statements as a rule. I deem them too hard to understand, and so I try to escape those questions. But it seems like what we have here is that there's three standards, IAS 36, 27, 28, that all refer to each other in terms of impairment, these issues, and we have what may be a hole, because 28 says for associates, go to 27. 27 says under IAS 39 or cost. If it's under IAS 39, I think we know the impairment model because that's in there. But if it's cost, well, we've just made that up. And IAS 36, going round and round, you can't figure out whether it says things at cost should be within its scope. IAS 39, I think, does not have a cost in its scope. So the board might resolve this through an annual improvement if they believe that this hole was by accident. That, you know, we meant to say that 39 applies. Maybe this could be done in an annual improvement rather than the big project.
I resisted putting this in because it's a comment coming from somebody else, but my successor, Ifrik, was here when IS 36 was written and was involved, and does claim in the notice he passed me that paragraph 4 of 36 was meant to address this and was meant to pull them into 36. Now, I say that, given that that's her rather than me, I resisted adding that, but it is the link that she sent me.
Well, this is not setting a precedent for when Laurence comes here, but sometimes memories expressed on the basis of conclusions aren't as clear as the people that actually wrote the standard. If it was, in fact, the intention to include it, then that's something that could be addressed as an annual improvement, because that certainly would fit the scope requirements for that. So perhaps we should change the conclusion in here to, because of the circularity and the lack of clarity as to which standard applies to these investments, that we would refer the matter to the board that they may consider including in the annual improvements project, and leave it at that. Would you agree with that approach? Do you want to give any steer to the board on what conclusion they should draw, or would Ken's successor's memory, faultless or otherwise, be sufficient guidance for them? Okay, staff, are we clear on that? So amend the wording, send that round to you. Not take it onto the agenda. I think some of us, anyway, have earned a mid-afternoon break. And so for the benefit of all, clock is running slow now, of course, but when Joanna has corrected the time on the clock, if we take 15 minutes, you'll be back here at 3:30. Thank you.